showed him the shield, which was like the shield that had been given to Gimli, and it bore on it the device of the white horse. "Take all these things," she said, "and bear them to good fortune. Farewell now, Master Merry Arduk. Yet maybe we shall meet again, you and I." So it was that amid a gathering gloom the King of the Mark made ready to lead all his riders on the eastward road. Hearts were heavy, and many quailed in the shadow. But they were a stern people, loyal to their lord, and little weeping or murmuring was heard, even in the camp in the hold where the exiles from Edoras were housed, women and children and old men. Doom hung over them, but they faced it silently. 2 swift hours passed, and now the king sat upon his white horse, glimmering in the half-light. Proud and tall he seemed, though the hair that flowed beneath his high helm was like snow, and many marvelled at him, and took heart to see him unbent and unafraid. There on the wide flats beside the noisy river were marshalled in many companies well nigh 50 hundreds of riders fully armed, and many hundreds of other men with spare horses lightly burdened. A single trumpet sounded. The king raised his hand, and then silently the host of the Mark began to move. Foremost went 12 of the king's household men, riders of renown. Then the king followed with Éomer on his right. He had said farewell to Éowyn above in the hold, and the memory was grievous. But now he turned his mind to the road that lay ahead. Behind him Merry rode on Stibber with the errand riders of Gondor, and behind them again 12 more of the king's household. They passed down the long ranks of waiting men with stern and unmoved faces. But when they had come almost to the end of the line, one looked up, glancing keenly at the hobbit. A young man, Merry thought as he returned the glance, less in height and girth than most. He caught the glint of clear grey eyes, and then he shivered, for it came suddenly to him that it was the face of one without hope who goes in search of death. On down the grey road they went beside the Snowbourne, rushing on its stones. Through the hamlets of Underharrow and Upbourne, where many sad faces of women looked out from dark doors, and so without horn or harp or music of men's voices, the great ride into the east began, with which the songs of Rohan were busy for many long lives of men thereafter.
From dark Dunharrow in the dim morning, with Thane and Captain rode Thangle's son. To Edoras he came, the ancient halls of the Mark Wardens mist enshrouded. Golden timbers were in gloom mantled. Farewell he bade to his free people, hearth and high seat and the hallowed places, where long he had feasted, ere the light had faded. Forth rode the king, fear behind him, fate before him, fealty kept he. Oaths he had taken, all fulfilled them, forth rode Theoden. 5 nights and days, east and onward, rode the Eyringers, through fold and fen march and the Firien wood, 6,000 spears to sun-lending, Mundberg the mighty under Mindolwin, sea-king city in the south kingdom, foe beleaguered, fire encircled, doom drove them on. Darkness took them, horse and horseman, hoofbeats afar, sank into silence, so the songs tell us.
It was indeed in deepening gloom that the king came to Edoras, although it was then but noon by the hour. There he halted only a short while, and strengthened his host by some 80 of riders that came late to the weapon-take. Now having eaten, he made ready to set out again, and he wished his esquire a kind farewell. But Merry begged, for the last time, not to be parted from him. "This is no journey for such steeds as Stibber, as I've told you," said Théoden. "And in such a battle as we think to make on the fields of Gondor, what would you do, Master Merry Arduk, sword-thane though you be, and greater of heart than of stature?" "As for that, who can tell?" answered Merry. "But why, Lord, did you receive me as sword thane, if not to stay by your side? And I would not have it said of me in song, only that I was always left behind." "I received you for your safekeeping," answered Theoden, "and also to do as I might bid. None of my riders can bear you as burden. If the battle were before my gates, maybe your deeds would be remembered by the minstrels. But it is 100 leagues and 2 to Mundberg when Denethor is lord. I will say no more." Merry bowed and went away unhappily, and stared at the lines of horsemen. Already the companies were preparing to start. Men were tightening girths, looking to saddles, caressing their horses. Some gazed uneasily at the lowering sky. Unnoticed, a rider came up and spoke softly in the hobbit's ear. "Where will wants not, a way opens, so we say," he whispered, "and so I have found myself." Merry looked up, and saw that it was the young rider whom he had noticed in the morning. "You wish to go whither the Lord of the Mark goes? I see it in your face."
"I do," said Merry.
"Then you shall go with me," said the rider. "I will bear you before me, under my cloak, until we are far afield, and this darkness is yet darker. Such goodwill should not be denied. Say no more to any man, but come."
"Thank you indeed," said Merry. "Thank you, sir, though I don't know your name."
"Do you not?" said the rider softly. "Then call me Durnhelm." Thus it came to pass that when the king set out, before Durnhelm sat Meriadoc the hobbit, and the great grey steed Windfola made little of the burden, for Durnhelm was less in weight than many men, though lithe and well-knit in frame. On into the shadow they rode, in the willow thickets where Snowborn flowed into Entwash, 12 leagues east of Edoras, they camped that night. And then on again through the fold, and through the fen march, where, to their right, great oak woods climbed on the skirts of the hills under the shades of dark Halifirion by the borders of Gondor. But away to their left the mists lay on the marshes fed by the mouths of Entwash. And as they rode, rumour came of war in the north. Lone men, riding wild, brought word of foes assailing their east borders, of orc hosts marching in the wold of Rohan.
"Ride on, ride on," cried Éomer. "Too late now to turn aside. The fens of Entwash must guard our flank. Haste now we need. Ride on."
And so King Theoden departed from his own realm, and mile by mile the long road wound away, and the beacon hills marched past. Caladhad, Minrimmon, Erelas, Nardal. But their fires were quenched. All the lands were grey and still, and ever the shadow deepened before them, and hope waned in every heart. Chapter 4. The Siege of Gondor. Pippin was roused by Gandalf. Candles were lit in their chamber, for only a dim twilight came through the windows. The air was heavy as with approaching thunder.
"What's the time?" said Pippin, yawning.
"Past the second hour," said Gandalf. "Time to get up and make yourself presentable. You are summoned to the Lord of the City to learn your new duties."
"And will he provide breakfast?"
"No, I have provided it. All that you will get till noon. Food is now doled out by order."
Pippin looked ruefully at the small loaf and, he thought, very inadequate pat of butter which was set out for him, beside a cup of thin milk.
"Why did you bring me here?" he said.
"You know quite well," said Gandalf, "to keep you out of mischief. And if you don't like being here, you can remember that you brought it on yourself."
Pippin said no more. Before long he was walking with Gandalf once more down the cold corridor to the door of the Tower Hall. There Denethor sat in a grey gloom, like an old patient spider, Pippin thought. He didn't seem to have moved since the day before. He beckoned Gandalf to a seat, but Pippin was left for a while standing unheeded. Presently the old man turned to him.
"Well, Master Peregrine, I hope that you used yesterday to your profit and to your liking, though I fear that the board is barer in this city than you could wish." Pippin had an uncomfortable feeling that most of what he had said or done was somehow known to the lord of the city, and much was guessed of what he thought as well. He didn't answer.
"What would you do in my service?"
"I thought, sir, that you would tell me my duties."
"I will, when I learn what you are fit for," said Denethor. "But that I shall learn soonest, maybe, if I keep you beside me. The esquire of my chamber has begged leave to go to the out-garrison, so you shall take his place for a while. You shall wait on me, bear errands, and talk to me, if war and council leave me any leisure. Can you sing?"
"Yes," said Pippin.
"Well, yes, well enough for my own people. But we have no songs fit for great halls and evil times, lord. We seldom sing of anything more terrible than wind or rain, and most of my songs are about things that make us laugh, or about food and drink, of course."
"And why should such songs be unfit for my halls, or for such hours as these? We who have lived long under the shadow may surely listen to echoes from a land untroubled by it. Then we may feel that our vigil was not fruitless, though it may have been thankless."
Pippin's heart sank. He didn't relish the idea of singing any song of the Shire to the lord of Minas Tirith, certainly not the comic ones that he knew best. They were too, well, rustic for such an occasion. He was, however, spared the ordeal for the present. He was not commanded to sing. Denethor turned to Gandalf, asking questions about the Rohirrim and their policies, and the position of Éomer, the king's nephew. Pippin marvelled at the amount that the lord seemed to know about a people that lived far away, though it must, he thought, be many years since Denethor himself had ridden abroad. Presently Denethor waved to Pippin, and dismissed him again for a while.
"Go to the armories of the citadel," he said, "and get you there the livery and gear of the tower. It will be ready. It was commanded yesterday. Return when you are clad."
It was as he said, and Pippin soon found himself arrayed in strange garments, all of black and silver. He had a small hauberk, its rings forged of steel, maybe, yet black as jet, and a high-crowned helm with small raven wings on either side, set with a silver star in the centre of the circlet. Above the mail was a short surcoat of black, but broidered on the breast in silver with a token of the tree. His old clothes were folded and put away, but he was permitted to keep the grey cloak of Lorien, though not to wear it when on duty. He looked now, had he known it, verily Ernil y Ferianeth, the prince of the halflings, that folk had called him, but he felt uncomfortable, and the gloom began to weigh on his spirits. It was dark and dim all day. From the sunless dawn until evening the heavy shadow had deepened, and all hearts in the city were oppressed. Far above, a great cloud streamed slowly westward from the black land, devouring light, borne upon a wind of war. But below, the air was still and breathless, as if all the Vale of Anduin waited for the onset of a ruinous storm. About the 11th hour, released at last for a while from service, Pippin came out and went in search of food and drink to cheer his heavy heart and to make his task of waiting more supportable. In the messes he met Beregond again, who had just come from an errand over the Pelennor out to the guard towers upon the causeway. Together they strolled out to the walls, for Pippin felt imprisoned indoors and stifled even in the lofty citadel. Now they sat side by side again, in the embrasure looking eastward, where they had eaten and talked the day before. It was the sunset hour, but the great pall had now stretched far into the west, and only as it sank at last into the sea did the sun escape to send out a brief farewell gleam before the night, even as Frodo saw it at the crossroads touching the head of the fallen king. But to the fields of the Pelennor, under the shadow of Min Dolwyn, there came no gleam. They were brown and drear. Already it seemed years to Pippin since he had sat there before, in some half-forgotten time, when he had still been a hobbit, a light-hearted wanderer touched little by the perils he had passed through. Now he was one small soldier in a city preparing for a great assault, clad in the proud but sombre manner of the Tower of God. In some other time and place, Pippin might have been pleased with his new array, but he knew now that he was taking part in no play. He was in deadly earnest the servant of a grim master in the greatest peril. The hauberk was burdensome, and the helm weighed upon his head. His cloak he had cast aside upon the seat. He turned his tired gaze away from the darkling fields below and yawned, and then he sighed.
"You are weary of this day," said Beregond.
"Yes," said Pippin, "very. Tired out with idleness and waiting. I've kicked my heels at the door of my master's chamber for many slow hours, while he's debated with Gandalf and the prince and other great persons, and I'm not used, Master Beregond, to waiting hungry on others while they eat. It's a sore trial for a hobbit, that. No doubt you will think I should feel the honour more deeply. But what is the good of such honour? Indeed, what is the good even of food and drink under this creeping shadow? What does it mean? The very air seems thick and brown. Do you often have such glooms when the wind is in the east?"
"Nay," said Beregond, "this is no weather of the world. This is some device of his malice, some broil of fume from the mountain of fire that he sends to darken hearts and counsel. And so it doth indeed. I wish the Lord Faramir would return. He would not be dismayed. But now, who knows if he will ever come back across the river out of the darkness?"
"Yes," said Pippin. "Gandalf, too, is anxious. He was disappointed, I think, not to find Faramir here. And where has he got to himself? He left the Lord's council before the noon meal, and in no good mood either, I thought. Perhaps he has some foreboding of bad news." Suddenly, as they talked, they were stricken dumb, frozen, as it were, to listening stones. Pippin cowered down with his hands pressed to his ears, but Beregond, who had been looking out from the battlement as he spoke to Faramir, remained there, stiffened, staring out with starting eyes. Pippin knew the shuddering cry that he had heard. It was the same that he had heard long ago in the Marish of the Shire, but now it was grown in power and hatred, piercing the heart with a poisonous despair. At last Beregond spoke with an effort.
"They have come," he said. "Take courage and look. There are fell things below."
Reluctantly Pippin climbed on to the seat and looked out over the wall. The Pelennor lay dim beneath him, fading away to the scarce-guessed line of the great river. But now, wheeling swiftly across it, like shadows of untimely night, he saw in the middle airs below him five bird-like forms, horrible as carrion fowl, yet greater than eagles, cruel as death. Now they swooped near, venturing almost within bowshot of the walls. Now they circled away.
"Black riders," muttered Pippin. "Black riders of the air. But see, Beregond," he cried, "they are looking for something, surely. See how they wheel and swoop, always down to that point over there. And can you see something moving on the ground? Dark little things. Yes, men on horses. Four or five. Ah, I cannot stand it. Gandalf, Gandalf, save us."
Another long screech rose and fell, and he threw himself back again from the wall, panting like a hunted animal. Faint and seemingly remote through that shuddering cry, he heard winding up from below the sound of a trumpet ending on a long, high note.
"Faramir! The Lord Faramir! It is his call!" cried Beregond. "Brave heart! But how can he win to the gate if these foul hell-hawks have other weapons than fear? But look! They hold on. They will make the gate.
No, the horses are running mad.
Look, the men are thrown. They are running on foot.
No, one is still up, but he rides back to the others. That will be the captain. He can master both beasts and men. Ah, there one of the foul things is stooping on him.
Help, help! Will no one go out to him? Faramir!"
With that, Beregond sprang away and ran off into the gloom, ashamed of his terror, while Beregond of the guard thought first of the captain whom he loved, Pippin got up and peered out. At that moment he caught a flash of white and silver coming from the north, like a small star down on the dusky fields. It moved with the speed of an arrow, and grew as it came, converging swiftly with the flight of the four men towards the gate. It seemed to Pippin that a pale light was spread about it, and the heavy shadows gave way before it. And then, as it drew near, he thought that he heard, like an echo in the walls, a great voice calling. "Gandalf!" he cried. "Gandalf! He always turns up when things are darkest. Go on! Go on, White Rider! Gandalf! Gandalf!" he shouted wildly, like an onlooker at a great race urging on a runner who is far beyond encouragement. But now the dark swooping shadows were aware of the newcomer. One wheeled towards him, but it seemed to Pippin that he raised his hand, and from it a shaft of white light stabbed upwards. The Nazgul gave a long wailing cry and swerved away, and with that the four others wavered, and then rising in swift spirals they passed away eastward, vanishing into the lowering cloud above, and down on the Pelennor it seemed for a while less dark. Pippin watched, and he saw the horseman and the White Rider meet and halt, waiting for those on foot. Men now hurried out to them from the city, and soon they all passed from sight under the outer walls, and he knew that they were entering the gate. Guessing that they would come at once to the tower and the steward, he hurried to the entrance of the citadel. There he was joined by many others who had watched the race and the rescue from the high walls. It was not long before a clamour was heard in the streets leading up from the outer circles, and there was much cheering and crying of the names of Faramir and Mithrandir. Presently Pippin saw torches, and followed by a press of people, two horsemen riding slowly. One was in white but shining no longer, pale in the twilight, as if his fire was spent or veiled. The other was dark, and his head was bowed. They dismounted, and as grooms took Shadowfax and the other horse, they walked forward to the sentinel at the gate. Gandalf steadily, his grey cloak flung back, and a fire still smouldering in his eyes. The other, clad all in green, slowly, swaying a little, as a weary or a wounded man. Pippin pressed forward as they passed under the lamp beneath the gate arch, and when he saw the pale face of Faramir, he caught his breath. It was the face of one who has been assailed by a great fear or anguish, but has mastered it and now is quiet. Proud and grave he stood for a moment as he spoke to the guard, and Pippin, gazing at him, saw how closely he resembled his brother Boromir, whom Pippin had liked from the first, admiring the great man's lordly but kindly manner. Yet suddenly for Faramir his heart was strangely moved with a feeling that he had not known before. Here was one with an air of high nobility such as Aragorn at times revealed, less high perhaps, yet also less incalculable and remote, one of the kings of men born into a later time, but touched with the wisdom and sadness of the elder race. He knew now why Beregon spoke his name with love. He was a captain that men would follow, that he would follow, even under the shadow of the black wings. "Faramir!" he cried aloud with the others. "Faramir!" And Faramir, catching his strange voice among the clamour of the men of the city, turned and looked down at him and was amazed.
"Whence came you?" he said. "A halfling? And in the livery of the tower? Whence?"
But with that Gandalf stepped to his side and spoke.
"He came with me from the land of the halflings," he said. "He came with me. But let us not tarry here. There is much to say and to do, and you are weary. He shall come with us. Indeed he must, for if he does not forget his new duties more easily than I do, he must attend on his lord again within this hour. Come, Pippin, follow us."
So at length they came to the private chamber of the lord of the city. There deep seats were set, about a brazier of charcoal, and wine was brought, and there Pippin, hardly noticed, stood behind the chair of Denethor, and felt his weariness little, so eagerly did he listen to all that was said. When Faramir had taken white bread and drunk a draught of wine, he sat upon a low chair at his father's left hand. Removed a little upon the other side sat Gandalf, in a chair of carven wood,
and he seemed at first to be asleep. For at the beginning Faramir spoke only of the errand upon which he had been sent out 10 days before, and he brought tidings of Ithilien, and of the movements of the enemy and his allies, and he told of the fight on the road, when the men of Harad and their great beast were overthrown, a captain reporting to his master such matters as had often been heard before, small things of border war that now seemed useless and petty, shorn of their renown. Then suddenly Faramir looked at Pippin. "But now we come to strange matters," he said. "For this is not the first halfling that I have seen walking out of the northern legends into the southlands." At that Gandalf sat up and gripped the arms of his chair, but he said nothing, and with a look stopped the exclamation on Pippin's lips. Denethor looked at their faces and nodded his head, as though in sign that he had read much there before it was spoken. Slowly, while the others sat silent and still, Faramir told his tale, with his eyes for the most part on Gandalf, though now and again his glance strayed to Pippin, as if to refresh his memory of others that he had seen. As his story was unfolded, of his meeting with Frodo and his servant, and of the events at Henneth Arnoon, Pippin became aware that Gandalf's hands were trembling as they clutched the carven wood. White they seemed now, and very old, and as he looked at them, suddenly with a thrill of fear, Pippin knew that Gandalf himself, was troubled, even afraid. The air of the room was close and still. At last, when Faramir spoke of his parting with the travellers, and of their resolve to go to Kirith Ungol, his voice fell, and he shook his head and sighed. Then Gandalf sprang up.
"Kirith Ungol? Morgul Vale?" he said. "The time, Faramir, the time. When did you part with them? When would they reach that accursed valley?"
"I parted with them in the morning 2 days ago," said Faramir. "It is 15 leagues thence to the Vale of the Morgul Duin, if they went straight south, and then they would be still 5 leagues westward of the accursed tower. At swiftest they could not come there before today, and maybe they have not come there yet. Indeed, I see what you fear, but the darkness is not due to their venture. It began yestereve, and all Ithilien was under shadow last night. It is clear to me that the enemy has long planned an assault on us, and its hour has already been determined before ever the travellers left my keeping." Gandalf paced the floor.
"The morning of 2 days ago, nigh on 3 days of journey. How far is the place where you parted?"
"Some 25 leagues as a bird flies," answered Faramir. "But I could not come more swiftly. Yestereve I lay at Caer Andros, the long isle in the river northward, which we hold in defence, and horses are kept on the hither bank. As the dark drew on, I knew that haste was needed, so I rode thence with 3 others that could also be horsed. The rest of my company I sent south to strengthen the garrison at the fords of Osgiliath. I hope that I have not done ill." He looked at his father.
"Ill?" cried Denethor, and his eyes flashed suddenly. "Why do you ask? The men were under your command. Or do you ask for my judgment on all your deeds? Your bearing is lowly in my presence, yet it is long now since you turned from your own way at my counsel. See, you have spoken skilfully as ever, but I, have I not seen your eye fixed on Mithrandir, seeking whether you said well or too much? He has long had your heart in his keeping."
"My son, your father is old but not yet dotard. I can see and hear, as was my wont, and little of what you have said, or left unsaid, is now hidden from me. I know the answer to many riddles. Alas, alas for Boromir!"
"If what I have done displeases you, my father," said Faramir quietly, "I wish I had known your counsel before the burden of so weighty a judgment was thrust on me."
"Would that have availed to change your judgment?" said Denethor. "You would still have done just so, I deem. I know you well. Ever your desire is to appear lordly and generous, as a king of old, gracious, gentle. That may well befit one of high race, if he sits in power and peace, but in desperate hours gentleness may be repaid with death."
"So be it," said Faramir. "So be it," cried Denethor, "but not with your death only, Lord Faramir, with the death also of your father, and of all your people, whom it is your part to protect now that Boromir is gone."
"Do you wish, then," said Faramir, "that our places had been exchanged?"
"Yes, I wish that indeed," said Denethor, "for Boromir was loyal to me and no wizard's pupil. He would have remembered his father's need, and would not have squandered what fortune gave. He would have brought me a mighty gift."
For a moment Faramir's restraint gave way. "I would ask you, my father, to remember why it was that I, not he, was in Ithilien. On one occasion at least, your counsel has prevailed, not long ago. It was the lord of the city that gave the errand to him."
"Stir not the bitterness in the cup that I mixed for myself," said Denethor. "Have I not tasted it now many nights upon my tongue, foreboding that worse yet lay in the dregs, as now indeed I find? Would it were not so, would that this thing had come to me."
"Comfort yourself," said Gandalf. "In no case would Boromir have brought it to you. He is dead, and died well. May he sleep in peace. Yet you deceive yourself. He would have stretched out his hand to this thing, and taking it, he would have fallen. He would have kept it for his own, and when he returned, you would not have known your son."
The face of Denethor set hard and cold.
"You found Boromir less apt to your hand, did you not?" he said softly. "But I, who was his father, say that he would have brought it to me. You are wise, maybe, Mithrandir, yet with all your subtleties you have not all wisdom. Counsels may be found that are neither the webs of wizards nor the hist of fools. I have in this matter more lore and wisdom than you deem."
"What, then, is your wisdom?" said Gandalf.
"Enough to perceive that there are two follies to avoid. To use this thing is perilous. At this hour, to send it in the hands of a witless halfling into the land of the enemy himself, as you have done, and this son of mine, that is madness."
"And the Lord Denethor, what would he have done?"
"Neither. But most surely not for any argument would he have set the thing at a hazard beyond all but a fool's hope, risking our utter ruin if the enemy should recover what he lost. Nay, it should have been kept hidden, hidden dark and deep, not used, I say, unless at the uttermost end of need, but set beyond his grasp, save by a victory so final that what then befell would not trouble us, being dead."
"You think, as is your wont, my lord, of Gondor only," said Gandalf. "Yet there are other men and other lives, and times still to be. And for me, I pity even his slaves."
"And where will other men look for help if Gondor falls?" answered Denethor. "If I had this thing now in the deep vaults of this citadel, we should not then shake with dread under this gloom, fearing the worst, and our counsels would be undisturbed."
"If you don't trust me to endure the test, you don't know me yet." "Nevertheless, I do not trust you," said Gandalf. "Had I done so, I could have sent this thing hither to your keeping, and spared myself and others much anguish. And now, hearing you speak, I trust you less, no more than Boromir. Nay, stay your wrath. I do not trust myself in this, and I refuse this thing, even as a freely given gift. You are strong and can still in some matters govern yourself, Denethor. Yet if you had received this thing, it would have overthrown you. Were it buried beneath the roots of Mindoliwin, still it would burn your mind away, as the darkness grows, and the yet worse things follow that soon will come upon us."
For a moment the eyes of Denethor glowed again as he faced Gandalf, and Pippin felt once more the strain between their wills. But now almost it seemed as if their glances were like blades from eye to eye, flickering as they fenced. Pippin trembled, fearing some dreadful stroke. But suddenly Denethor relaxed and grew cold again. He shrugged his shoulders.
"If I had, if you had," he said,
"such words and ifs are vain.
It has gone into the shadow, and only time will show what doom awaits it and us. The time will not be long. In what is left, let all who fight the enemy in their fashion be at one, and keep hope while they may,
and after hope still the hardihood to die free. He turned to Faramir. What think you of the garrison at Osgiliath?
It is not strong, said Faramir. I have sent the company of Ithilien to strengthen it, as I have said.
Not enough, I deem, said Denethor. It is there that the first blow will fall. They will have need of some stout captain there.
There and elsewhere in many places, said Faramir, and sighed.
Alas for my brother, whom I too loved, he rose. May I have your leave, father?
And then he swayed and leaned upon his father's chair.
You are weary, I see, said Denethor. You have ridden fast and far, and under shadows of evil in the air, I am told.
Let us not speak of that, said Faramir.
Then we will not, said Denethor. Go now and rest as you may. Tomorrow's need will be sterner.
All now took leave of the lord of the city, and went to rest while they still could. Outside there was a starless blackness as Gandalf, with Pippin beside him bearing a small torch, made his way to their lodging. They did not speak until they were behind closed doors. Then at last Pippin took Gandalf's hand.
"Tell me," he said, "is there any hope? For Frodo, I mean, or at least mostly for Frodo."
Gandalf put his hand on Pippin's head.
"There never was much hope," he answered. "Just a fool's hope, as I've been told. And when I heard of Cirith Ungol—"
He broke off and strode to the window, as if his eyes could pierce the night in the east.
"Cirith Ungol," he muttered. "Why that way, I wonder?"
He turned.
"Just now, Pippin, my heart almost failed me, hearing that name. And yet in truth I believe that the news that Faramir brings has some hope in it. For it seems clear that our enemy has opened his war at last, and made the first move while Frodo was still free. So now, for many days, he will have his eye turned this way and that, away from his own land. And yet, Pippin, I feel from afar his haste and fear. He has begun sooner than he would. Something has happened to stir him."
Gandalf stood for a moment and thought.
"Maybe," he muttered. "Maybe even your foolishness helped, my lad. Let me see. Some 5 days ago now, he would discover that we had thrown down Saruman, and had taken the stone. Still, what of that? We could not use it to much purpose, or without his knowing. Ah, I wonder. Aragorn! His time draws near, and he is strong and stern underneath, Pippin. Bold, determined, able to take his own counsel, and dare great risks at need. That may be it. He may have used the stone, and shown himself to the enemy, challenging him for this very purpose. I wonder. Well, we shall not know the answer till the riders of Rohan come, if they do not come too late. There are evil days ahead. To sleep while we may."
"But," said Pippin.
"But what?" said Gandalf. "Only one but will I allow to-night."
"Gollum," said Pippin. "How on earth could they be going about with him, even following him? And I could see that Faramir didn't like the place he was taking them to any more than you do. What's wrong?"
"I cannot answer that now," said Gandalf. "Yet my heart guessed that Frodo and Gollum would meet before the end, for good or for evil. But of Cirith Ungol I will not speak to-night. Treachery, treachery, I fear, treachery of that miserable creature. But so it must be. Let us remember that a traitor may betray himself, and do good that he does not intend. It can be so sometimes. Good night."
The next day came with a morning like a brown dusk, and the hearts of men, lifted for a while by the return of Faramir, sank low again. The winged shadows were not seen again that day, yet ever and anon, high above the city, a faint cry would come, and many who heard it would stand stricken with a passing dread, while the less stout-hearted quailed and wept. And now Faramir was gone again. "They give him no rest," some murmured. "The Lord drives his son too hard, and now he must do the duty of two, for himself and for the one that will not return. And ever men looked northward, asking, Where are the riders of Rohan? In truth, Fanamir did not go by his own choosing. But the lord of the city was master of his counsel, and he was in no mood that day to bow to others. Early in the morning the council had been summoned. There all the captains judged that because of the threat in the south, their force was too weak to make any stroke of war on their own part, unless perchance the riders of Rohan yet should come. Meanwhile, they must man the walls and wait.
Yet, said Denethor, we should not lightly abandon the outer defences, the Rama's made with so great a labour, and the enemy must pay dearly for the crossing of the river.
That he cannot do, in force to assail the city, either north of Caer Andros because of the marshes, or southwards towards Lebenin because of the breadth of the river that needs many boats. It is at Osgiliath that he will put forth his weight, as before when Boromir denied him the passage.
That was but a trial, said Faramir.
Today we may make the enemy pay 10 times our loss at the passage, and yet rue the exchange, for he can afford to lose a host better than we to lose a company, and the retreat of those that we put out far afield will be perilous if he wins across in force.
And what of Caer Andros? Said the prince. That, too, must be held, if Osgiliath is defended. Let us not forget the danger on our left. The Rohirrim may come, and they may not. But Faramir has told us of great strength drawing ever to the Black Gate. More than one host may issue from it, and strike for more than one passage.
Much must be risked in war, said Denethor. Caer Andros is manned, and no more can be sent so far. But I will not yield the river and the Pelennor unfought, not if there is a captain here who has still the courage to do his lord's will.
Then all were silent, but at length Faramir said, I do not oppose your will, sire.
Since you are robbed of Boromir, I will go and do what I can in his stead, if you command it.
I do so, said Denethor.
Then farewell, said Faramir. But if I should return, think better of me.
That depends on the manner of your return, said Denethor.
Gandalf it was that last spoke to Faramir ere he rode east.
Do not throw your life away rashly or in bitterness, he said. You will be needed here, for other things than war. Your father loves you, Faramir, and will remember it ere the end. Farewell.
So now the Lord Faramir had gone forth again, and had taken with him such strength of men as were willing to go or could be spared. On the wall some gazed through the gloom towards the ruined city, and they wondered what chanced there, for nothing could be seen, and others, as ever, looked north and counted the leagues to Theoden in Rohan. Will he come? Will he remember our old alliance? They said.
Yes, he will come, said Gandalf. Even if he comes too late. But think, at best the Red Arrow cannot have reached him more than 2 days ago, and the miles are long from Edoras.
It was night again ere news came. A man rode in haste from the fords, saying that a host had issued from Minas Morgul and was already drawing nigh to Osgiliath, and it had been joined by regiments from the south, Haradrim, cruel and tall. And we have learned, said the messenger, that the black captain leads them once again, and the fear of him has passed before him over the river. With those ill-boding words, the third day closed since Pippin came to Minas Tirith. Few went to rest, for small hope had any now that even Faramir could hold the fords for long. The next day, though the darkness had reached its full and grew no deeper, it weighed heavier on men's hearts, and a great dread was on them. Ill news came soon again. The passage of Andwin was won by the enemy. Faramir was retreating to the wall of the Pelennor, rallying his men to the causeway forts, but he was 10 times outnumbered.
If he wins back at all across the Pelennor,
His enemies will be on his heels, said the messenger. They've paid dear for the crossing, but less dearly than we hoped. The plan has been well laid. It is now seen that in secret they have long been building floats and barges in great numbers in east of Gilead. They swarmed across like beetles. But it is the black captain that defeats us. Few will stand and abide even the rumour of his coming. His own folk quail at him, and they would slay themselves at his bidding.
Then I am needed there more than here, said Gandalf, and rode off at once, and the glimmer of him faded soon from sight. And all that night Pippin alone and sleepless stood upon the wall and gazed eastward. The bells of day had scarcely rung out again, a mockery in the unlightened dark, when far away he saw fires spring up, across in the dim spaces where the walls of the Pelennor stood. The watchmen cried aloud, and all men in the city stood to arms. Now ever and anon there was a red flash, and slowly through the heavy air dull rumbles could be heard. "They have taken the wall," men cried. "They are blasting breaches in it. They are coming." "Where is Faramir?" cried Beregond in dismay. "Say not that he has fallen." It was Gandalf that brought the first tidings. With a handful of horsemen he came in the middle morning, riding as escort to a line of wains. They were filled with wounded men, all that could be saved from the wreck of the causeway forts. At once he went to Denethor. The lord of the city now sat in a high chamber above the hall of the White Tower, with Pippin at his side, and through the dim windows, north and south and east, he bent his dark eyes, as if to pierce the shadows of doom that ringed him round. Most to the north he looked, and would pause at whiles to listen, as if by some ancient art his ears might hear the thunder of hoofs on the plains far away.
"Is Faramir come?" he asked.
"No," said Gandalf. "But he still lived when I left him. Yet he is resolved to stay with the rearguard, lest the retreat over the Pelennor become a rout. He may, perhaps, hold his men together long enough, but I doubt it. He is pitted against a foe too great, for one has come that I feared."
"Not the Dark Lord!" cried Pippin, forgetting his place in his terror. Denethor laughed bitterly.
"Nay, not yet, Master Peregrine. He will not come save only to triumph over me when all is won. He uses others as his weapons. So do all great lords, if they are wise, Master Halfling. Or why should I sit here in my tower and think and watch and wait, spending even my sons, for I can still wield a brand?"
He stood up and cast open his long black cloak, and behold, he was clad in mail beneath, and girt with a long sword, great hilted in a sheath of black and silver.
"Thus have I walked, and thus now for many years have I slept," he said, "lest with age the body should grow soft and timid.
Yet now, under the lord of Barad-dûr, the most fell of all his captains is already master of your outer walls," said Gandalf. "King of Angmar, long ago, sorcerer, ringwraith, lord of the Nazgûl, a spear of terror in the hand of Sauron, shadow of despair."
"Then, Mithrandir, you had a foe to match you," said Denethor. "For myself, I've long known who is the chief captain of the hosts of the Dark Tower. Is this all that you have returned to say? Or can it be that you have withdrawn because you were overmatched?"
Pippin trembled, fearing that Gandalf would be stung to sudden wrath, but his fear was needless.
"It might be so," Gandalf answered softly, "but our trial of strength is not yet come, and if words spoken of old be true, not by the hand of man shall he fall, and hidden from the wise is the doom that awaits him. However that may be, the captain of despair does not press forward yet. He rules rather according to the wisdom that you have just spoken, from the rear, driving his slaves in madness on before. Nay, I came rather to guard the hurt men that can yet be healed, for the Ramas is breached far and wide, and soon the host of Morgul will enter in at many points, and I came chiefly to say this. Soon there will be battle on the fields, a sortie must be made ready. Let it be of mounted men.
In them lies our brief hope, for in one thing only is the enemy still poorly provided. He has few horsemen.
And we also have few. Now would the coming of Rohan be in the nick of time, said Denethor.
We are likely to see other newcomers first, said Gandalf. Fugitives from Kaer Andros have already reached us. The isle has fallen. Another army has come from the Black Gate, crossing from the northeast.
Some have accused you, Mithrandir, of delighting to bear ill news, said Denethor. But to me this is no longer news. It was known to me ere nightfall yesterday. As for the sortie, I had already given thought to it. Let us go down.
Time passed. At length, watchers on the walls could see the retreat of the out-companies. Small bands of weary and often wounded men came first with little order. Some were running wildly as if pursued. Away to the eastward, the distant fires flickered. Now it seemed that here and there they crept across the plain. Houses and barns were burning. Then from many points little rivers of red flame came hurrying on, winding through the gloom, converging towards the line of the broad road that led from the city gate to Osgiliath.
The enemy, men murmured. The dyke is down.
Here they come, pouring through the breaches, and they carry torches, it seems. Where are our own folk?
It drew now to evening by the hour, and the light was so dim that even far-sighted men upon the citadel could discern little clearly out upon the fields, save only the burnings that ever multiplied, and the lines of fire that grew in length and speed. At last, less than a mile from the city, a more ordered mass of men came into view, marching, not running, still holding together. The watchers held their breath.
Faramir must be there, they said. He can govern man and beast. He will make it yet.
Now the main retreat was scarcely 2 furlongs distant. Out of the gloom behind, a small company of horsemen galloped, all that was left of the rear guard. Once again they turned at bay, facing the oncoming lines of fire. Then suddenly there was a tumult of fierce cries. Horsemen of the enemy swept up. The lines of fire became flowing torrents, file upon file of orcs bearing flames, and wild Southron men with red banners, shouting with harsh tongues, surging up, overtaking the retreat. And with a piercing cry, out of the dim sky fell the winged shadows, the Nazgul stooping to the kill. The retreat became a rout. Already men were breaking away, flying wild and witless here and there, flinging away their weapons, crying out in fear, falling to the ground. And then a trumpet rang from the citadel, and Denethor at last released the sortie. Drawn up within the shadow of the gate and under the looming walls outside, they had waited for his signal. All the mounted men that were left in the city. Now they sprang forward, formed, quickened to a gallop, and charged with a great shout. And from the walls an answering shout went up, for foremost on the field rode the Swan Knights of Dol Amroth with their prince and his blue banner at their head. "Amroth for Gondor," they cried. "Amroth to Faramir!" Like thunder they broke upon the enemy on either flank of the retreat. But one rider outran them all, swift as the wind in the grass. Shadowfax bore him, shining, unveiled once more, a light starting from his upraised hand. The Nazgul screeched and swept away, for their captain was not yet come to challenge the white fire of his foe. The hosts of Morgul, intent on their prey, taken at unawares in wild career, broke, scattering like sparks in a gale. The out-companies, with a great cheer, turned and smote their pursuers. Hunters became the hunted. The retreat became an onslaught. The field was strewn with stricken orcs and men, and a reek arose of torches cast away, sputtering out in swirling smoke. The cavalry rode on. But Denethor did not permit them to go far. Though the enemy was checked, and for the moment driven back, great forces were flowing in from the east. Again the trumpet rang, sounding the retreat. The cavalry of Gondor halted. Behind their screen, the out-companies reformed. Now steadily they came marching back. They reached the gate of the city and entered.
stepping proudly. And proudly the people of the city looked on them, and cried their praise, and yet they were troubled in heart, for the companies were grievously reduced. Tharamir had lost a third of his men, and where was he? Last of all he came. His men passed in, the mounted knights returned, and at their rear the banner of Dol Amroth and the prince. And in his arms before him on his horse he bore the body of his kinsman, Tharamir, son of Denethor, found upon the stricken field. "Tharamir! Tharamir!" men cried, weeping in the streets. But he did not answer, and they bore him away up the winding road to the citadel and his father. Even as the Nazgul had swerved aside from the onset of the White Rider, there came flying a deadly dart, and Tharamir, as he held at bay a mounted champion of Harad, had fallen to the earth. Only the charge of Dol Amroth had saved him from the red Southland swords that would have hewed him as he lay. The Prince Imrahil brought Tharamir to the White Tower, and he said, "Your son has returned, Lord, after great deeds," and he told all that he had seen. But Denethor rose and looked on the face of his son and was silent. Then he bade them make a bed in the chamber and lay Tharamir upon it and depart. But he himself went up alone into the secret room under the summit of the tower, and many who looked up thither at that time saw a pale light that gleamed and flickered from the narrow windows for a while, and then flashed and went out. And when Denethor descended again, he went to Tharamir and sat beside him without speaking, but the face of the Lord was grey, more death-like than his son's. So now at last the city was besieged, enclosed in a ring of foes. The Ramas was broken, and all the Pelennor abandoned to the enemy. The last word to come from outside the walls was brought by men flying down the northward road ere the gate was shut. They were the remnant of the guard that was kept at that point where the way from Anorion and Rohan ran into the townlands. Ingold led them, the same who had admitted Gandalf and Pippin less than 5 days before, while the sun still rose and there was hope in the morning. "There is no news of the Rohirrim," he said. "Rohan will not come now, or if they come, it will not avail us. The new host that we had tidings of has come first, from over the river by way of Andros, it is said. They're strong, battalions of orcs of the eye, and countless companies of men of a new sort that we have not met before. Not tall, but broad and grim, bearded like dwarves, wielding great axes. Out of some savage land in the wide east they come, we deem. They hold the northward road, and many have passed on into Anorion. The Rohirrim cannot come." The gate was shut. All night, watchmen on the walls heard the rumour of the enemy that roamed outside, burning field and tree, and hewing any man that they found abroad, living or dead. The numbers that had already passed over the river could not be guessed in the darkness, but when morning, or its dim shadow, stole over the plain, it was seen that even fear by night had scarcely overcounted them. The plain was dark with their marching companies, and as far as eyes could strain in the murk there sprouted, like a foul fungus growth, all about the beleaguered city great camps of tents, black or sombre red. Busy as ants, hurrying orcs were digging lines of deep trenches in a huge ring, just out of bowshot from the walls, and as the trenches were made each was filled with fire, though how it was kindled or fed, by art or devilry, none could see. All day the labour went forward, while the men of Minas Tirith looked on, unable to hinder it. And as each length of trench was completed, they could see great wains approaching, and soon yet more companies of the enemy were swiftly setting up, each behind the cover of a trench, great engines for the casting of missiles. There were none upon the city walls large enough to reach so far or to stay the work. At first men laughed and did not greatly fear such devices, for the main wall of the city was of great height and marvellous thickness, built ere the power and craft of Numenor waned in exile, and its outward face was like to the tower of Orthonk, hard and dark and smooth, unconquerable by steel or fire, unbreakable except by some convulsion that would rend the very earth on which it stood.
"Nay," they said, "not if the Nameless One himself